Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today we're joined by Nate Zimmerman. Nate is a senior partner and executive recruiter at High Country Private Equity Search in Denver. With over $1 million billed consecutively for the last 2 years and career billings surpassing $6.6 million, Nate has distinguished himself in the competitive world of recruiting with his relentless focus on putting the relationship before the transaction. I've met Nate in person twice. He's a super nice guy, and I know you're going to enjoy hearing his journey in becoming the youngest partner at High Country and the valuable lessons he's learned along the way. Nate, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to it, Mark.
Fantastic. So listen, I've really enjoyed sitting next to you and Monty for dinner at the Pinnacle Conference in Savannah recently. That was a lot of fun. And as you know, and many of our listeners know, Monty Mertz was on the podcast. If you haven't already heard that, it's episode 59, How to Build a Multi-Million Dollar Team of Recruitment Rockstars. I guess you're one of the rock stars he was talking about.
Yeah, we all do what we can here. It's a lot of fun. Things just happen.
All right. Fantastic. So I'd love to dive into your origin story because I've already heard it when we had dinner together. And I think it's a fun story. So your recruitment career began with a cold call. Could you tell the story of how you got into recruiting?
Sure. Yeah. It's like I tell this often, but I was at a bit of a crossroads in my career. Was living in New York. Was working in the sports industry, so sports marketing. Had a great job. Was enrolled in a fantastic graduate school program, and at the time was with my girlfriend, now my wife, and you could tell just things weren't necessarily clicking. And felt like that was an important relationship and potentially my long-term person. And so just did a kind of full evaluation kind of my life and what I was passionate about and so on and so forth. And yeah, I'd always been good at recruiting, whether it was, raising money for nonprofits in college, all of the jobs that I'd had to date at that point, I'd actually recruited either successfully or sometimes unsuccessfully, but tried to recruit friends to the companies I was working at. And so, yeah, I said, okay, my wife, girlfriend at the time said we should move to Denver. I was like, okay, give me a couple of weeks to figure out what I'm going to do. And I narrowed down, to a couple of choices and decided I wanted to be an executive recruiter and had a sense that a big national firm probably wasn't the best place for me in terms of, personality and what I was suited for. So, I guess they did have the internet back then in 2013 and it came across High Country Search Group, seemed like a good place. And I don't know how, cause I didn't have Zoom info, but somehow or other, I got Monty's cell phone and got him on the phone. And I think my pitch was, hey man, listen, I've never done recruiting, but I'm moving to Denver. And if you don't hire me, it'll be the biggest mistake of your business life. And he's just taken aback and said, okay, well, we're not hiring, but seems like you got a little bit of game on the phone. Let's chat. Tell me more about yourself. And so we had a nice conversation. It was fairly cursory, but I remember at the end of it, he's, kind of said, well, look, we like, what we pride ourselves on is our culture and, families, personal life. But tell me more about yourself outside of work. What do you enjoy? So I love to, I cook and read and really passionate about sports. That's the industry I'm coming from. I play soccer. I love to run. He's like, oh, you like to run, huh? I was like, yeah, absolutely. Like, okay, well, tell you what, since you said you're going to be in Denver next week, why don't you meet me Tuesday morning, 9:30, Matthew Interstate State Park. So I'm writing this down, Matthew Interstate Park too. He's like, awesome. I'll see you there. And so, then I go have to book a flight, right? Because of course I wasn't going to be in Denver next week.
That's good.
So I booked a flight. I had a buddy that I grew up with who happened to live there. And so came in, stayed with him. Next morning, I meet him at Matthew Interstate Park. Mind you, Matthew Interstate Park, this is not Denver proper. This is sort of halfway up to the mountain. So meet him in the parking lot and shake hands and says, so you want to do 4 8-miles? And I said, well, if I say 4, is that going to hurt my chance at the job? And he said, no. So we just start running and chatting about life and business and the industry of recruiting. And, adrenaline is just coursing through my veins, right? I mean, I'm coming from sea level effectively. And so we had this great run. And at the end of it, I'm drinking the Kool-Aid. I'm like, God, this is awesome. He says, well, meet me tomorrow morning. We do a training every Wednesday, 7:30 a.m. Just be at the office tomorrow morning. And so, you know, like I'm so green. I brought a suit, a nice suit and a tie and all this. So I show up Wednesday morning. Everybody's just like cockeyed, looks at me like, who is this, you know, a-hole coming in with the suit? And I actually, Mark, it's Wednesday morning right now. And we just finished our Wednesday morning training. So, you know, 10 and a half years later, talk about consistency as a big, you know, I think anybody in this industry will say it's a big part of your success needs to be consistency. We still do that training every Wednesday morning. The training has actually moved now to 8 a.m. It's not 7:30 anymore, but did that training and spent some time with some other folks in the office. Monty checked references and I walked out of the door that Wednesday with an offer and then sort of the next couple of weeks just got myself moved out and was reading everything I could about recruiting. And I really went, I think there was a period of 4 or 5 days once I was moved out to Denver where I went into a coffee shop. And that's something we could talk about later, Mark, you know, some of the specific tactics that I employed early in my career to get ahead. But I remember just so vividly the coffee shop was like, Monty's, you know, we have all these training tapes, which we still have access to and give to newbies, our rookies. But I did all the Lefko stuff and then all the Danny Cahill stuff. So I was ready, you know, whatever it was, August 21st, 2013, when I started, I came in guns blazing. Well, yeah, I was just going to add, and I don't want to get into every job I had, you know, prior, but, you know, on one hand, I do wish I'd started recruiting right out of school because, you know, I'd be so much wealthier than I am today, but I'm richer in experience and relationships because of all the different jobs I've had. So I think, you know, anybody listening, if you're not loving, you know, what you're doing right now, take solace in the fact that there are little wins that you can build up and relationships that are, you know, if you do right by people and do right by yourself, it's all going to be paid forward. But
absolutely, nothing's ever wasted. You know,
I think that makes me right.
You can every experience, whether it's positive, negative, or sort of neutral, you can take something out of it that's going to serve you moving forward. Right. And, but what's interesting, Nate, is, well, there's a couple of things. That's the first time I've heard of someone doing a first interview while running 4 miles, at altitude. That's awesome. Second takeaway there, and I hope our owners are all taking note that, because I tell all of our coaching clients that they should run weekly workshops. And they're like, that sounds like a lot of work. And I'm like, I'm telling you, like, doing training once a month or sporadically is not enough. Like, you can almost not do too much training. And you guys are all, you know, super achievers and high billers, and you're still doing those weekly workshops consistently every week. So I love that. But you kind of skimmed over, like, why did you settle on executive search out of everything you could do? What was it that it kind of attracted you, or what did you think it was going to be?
I think, and I don't know if it's in equal parts, but look, let's not BS. I mean, money,
sure,
that was a primary concern. I heard you could do well. And you know, I was working in an industry that did have kind of odd hours, event driven. So you were not, to a large extent, your schedule was not under your control. So knowing that it potentially would afford me more synergy with my lifestyle.
Yeah.
And then the you know, making a difference. Certainly still, like, I get up and that's a big part of it. Like, I'm proud to do what I do. I add value. I contribute to the economy. So again, and no, that's not, those aren't force ranked, but those were, and look, I knew I would be successful. I was always, you know, either typically number one in whatever kind of sales category, whatever it was that I was doing. And so, you know, I wanted to do a more of a straight sales role than I was in at the time.
So. Fantastic. Yeah, no, that is awesome. So you started to talk about, and I'd like to get into talking about work ethic. I know you believe in the importance of investing time and effort to develop your skills and accelerate your career, especially at the outset of your recruitment career. Could you give an example or story that, you know, from your own career of how you've really put in the work early on?
Yeah, I think prior to talking about any sort of direct job, like knowing the underlying basics, the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. So that's what I focused on initially, like, you know, how to recruit people, right? How to interview people, how to take a job order, how to, you know, try to get a job order. Those things you got to put in the time and effort, and that's through training. But then honestly, making use, I think the biggest key to my early success was just making use of time, like not 9 to 5. So, you know, if you're trying to build a full desk and get new clients, like researching after hours, who are the companies I want to go after? And then building your, at the time it was like, building a phone tree, really. Mm-hmm. Who are all the line managers in a given company? And then, you know, when you show up at the office, that's just, and this is 101 stuff, Mark, but that's not the time to do that sort of research. Right. So I initially it wasn't as much like the late nights. I mean, yeah, I'd work, you know, till 7, maybe 8, but on the weekends, like spend 2 to 3 hours, you know, Saturday and Sunday every weekend for the first couple of years you're in this industry, doing that just really basic research. And it's contributing long-term to your market mastery. Mm-hmm. So nothing, every hour that you're spending, I promise you, and especially if you're inputting your data correctly, like that's all going to pay dividends. And just too many people come in without a plan earlier in their career, and it's deadly because it's a really tough job.
Absolutely. 100%. It is a tough job. And so paint a picture then of what that would entail. Like what was the daily itinerary, you know, in terms of doing that research and preparing yourself for the next day?
Right. I mean, I think some people have different philosophies. My go-to, you know, always would be to market in the morning. So, you know, planning, whether it's, you know, just looking at job boards and seeing who's hiring and trying to call those hiring managers. Typically not the best way as a, you know, as a new person. Now, if you have a candidate, that's a different story and MPCing. But, you know, I'm a believer in quality. So it's not like trying to market to, for me, it was never trying to market to 100 companies. It was saying, okay, these are the 10 or so groups that are in the discipline that I want to play in. Mm. And just really trying to focus on getting just one of those. If you can land, you know, a quarter, one good client, you know, and showing that you've taken time to learn their business, marketing, you know, candidates that are going to resonate with that firm to them directly. So it was a bit more quality, high touch. Mm-hmm. In terms of how I went about building my desk. It worked out.
And so it's interesting because we call that the Dream 100 strategy, which is a term I got from a sales trainer called Chet Holmes, where you identify who are the ideal clients in your space, the ones that have the most potential, based on the parameters that you're looking for, and really going above and beyond, making a huge effort. It's not just call them once, but it's really a sales and marketing campaign over time to get into those accounts. And out of 100, well, the 100 is a nominal number. You said 10, like let's focus on 10. And these are the sort of opportunities that even if you got one, that would be a significant win. And if you get 2 or 3, then, you know, you're well on your way. In terms of becoming the youngest partner at High Country Search Group, I mean, that's a phenomenal achievement. Can you tell us more about that journey, Nate, and what it really took to achieve that?
Yeah, sure. So High Country Search Group is made up of a few different divisions. We have a staffing group that does, you know, temporary admin, contract, even some high level contract roles. We've got a finance and accounting group. That was the group that I started in. We have a oil and gas group and a technology group. And so independent of whichever division you're in, the parameters for partnership are the same. We don't need to get too far into that, but you know, you've got to bill a certain amount, you know, consistently for 3 out of 5 years, and you have been at the firm for 5 years. So very black and white, and that's consistency is, you know what you get at High Country, and that'll never change. So early on, that was I think that's a goal of everybody who comes here. And I think in my first year, you know, whatever it was, here for 4 months, build X amount, and then next year just focused on getting to Mexico, right? Our awards trip, and that's billing 300. And then, you know, the next goal is to qualify for that partnership level, which is billing 400K, that, you know, that consistently 400K 3 out of 5 years, having been in the firm 5 years. And so I think I did that in my second full year, and then just never looked back. And to be honest, Mark, and I think this has become in vogue with James Clear and sort of talking about habit formation. Yep. But I've innately, like, I have never focused on a number for a goal. It's always just been about the process for me. So that, you know, talking about putting in that extra time, and that's always been my process to kind of come a little bit more prepared. Clearly, like, nobody's perfect at this, but that, you know, of course I wanted to hit that 300 to get to Mexico. I then never thought again about billing 300K. It was, what's the next thing? The next thing is 400, because that's what you have to build to qualify for partnership. And then after billing 400 in my second full year, I never thought about that. You know, I always knew I was going to bill over 400.
Okay. Let's double click on this, Nate, because so most of our listeners probably know I'm a huge fan of Atomic Habits by James Clear. And something that James Clear said, which I thought was interesting, I do believe in setting goals, and I think there's value in having a vision that you're moving towards and knowing exactly what you want. But James Clear says, you know, if setting goals in and of itself was enough, then everybody would be a millionaire, right? Because it's not enough just to have something that you want. What's more important is, so that's an outcome goal. But it's more important to focus on what's the process to getting there and focus on the process goals. So how did you, like, what was the process that you focused on in order to, you know, put yourself on track to achieve those milestones for the Mexico trip and then, you know, making partner?
If I had to pinpoint one thing, you know, initially in my career, I started in our finance and accounting group, and a senior guy, when I first started, said, if you're going to do one thing, try to focus on recruiting big four auditors to place into industry. And yeah, he was a very successful guy, still is. And so that was all I did. I was a freaking bulldog. All I did was go after recruiting these big four auditors. And I recruited more big four auditors than anybody in Denver. I mean, I would at any point in time, this was sort of like the glory days of this. But at any point in time, I'd have 4 or 5, you know, 2, 3, 4 year candidates ready to go. I'd be sending these candidates out to like 5, 6 different jobs of other people in my firm. You know, I'd be covering all their jobs. And interestingly, it was so that, I'd say the first 3, 4 years of my career, that's the only sort of candidate I recruited, which, you know, fortuitously actually led me to becoming more of a specialist and, you know, ultimately breaking off and starting my own group, was because of the many of the auditors that I was recruiting happened to be specialized in auditing a certain type of client. And so not only did it, you know, I had the immediate, you know, success of creating enough billings to go to Mexico and then qualifying for partnership, but it also, you know, that dedication led me down to the path of finding a niche that I was, you know, more passionate about and have carried on now to this day.
Okay, that's interesting. So one success factor was having being very focused really on a niche and having a very clear strategy as to what you're going to do. You're taking big four auditors and placing them in industry. And you, as you self-described, bulldog. So that's what you really just focused on doing. And then that led you ultimately to even niching further, which we'll talk about later.
And getting back to that process, you know, if whatever your niche is, if you have a great candidate, stop everything you're doing. Like, don't, like, literally turn your phone off, write a great MPC script, find 20, 30, 40 hiring managers that you know, whether or not they're hiring right now, that candidate, if presented with that candidate, they're at least going to stop, read the email and say, this person, whoever sent me the email, they know what I'm interested in. They know that this will resonate. They took the time. And even if they don't respond, that's okay, because they're seeing that you know what you're doing. And then, you know, call them 2 weeks later and say, hey, I get it. You're probably not hiring. You saw my email though, right? Like, I want your business. Like, I know what I'm doing. Give me a shot. And so that's what I would do with those big four candidates. I mean, just, you know, brings back fond memories just talking about it.
Yeah, no, that's great. And so let's get tactical for a minute, because, and do you still use MBC marketing as one of the pillars of your practice?
No, I don't. Okay. I don't, but I'm going to get back to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
What, so why don't you?
This is not an excuse. This is just me having been busy and not, you know, having a growth mindset as much, and being fortunate, you know, in somewhat of a down market right now, you know, with interest rates being high, transaction volume being down across the board, whatever industry you're in. But having good job orders over the last 2 years, and having grown through referral, the emphasis on new business development, outside of referrals has been almost nil. But that is definitely changing heading into next year.
Right.
Much more of a growth mindset, and excited about, you know, getting back to that side of the business.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So MPC marketing is something that is one of many strategies that we teach in our program. And it's, our methodology is very systematic. So it's more of a campaign. So you'd have what I liked about what you said is, if you have a true, I think the mistake a lot of people make is they think they have an MPC, but it's not really it's not a true MPC, right? It's, you know, there is a difference between a good person who's placeable if you had the right opportunity and someone whose people will feel stupid not interviewing because they're so good. They almost can't, you know, say no to that person.
That's right.
And then asking the candidate the right questions to uncover their, you know, quantifiable achievements and where they're really going to add measurable value. And then, as you said, creating a really good script for that person. And then being very targeted in the hiring managers that you're representing that individual to, but then just being super persistent. So we would typically use 3 to 5 email sequence, possibly some personalized videos in there, you know, possibly some follow-up telephone calls to, you know, so that there's multiple touch points for, you know, for that candidate with each prospect company. And as you said, even if they're not hiring right now and they can't take your candidate, at least they know the quality of the person that you have access to and that you specialize in that area and, you know, that you know the industry and so on and so forth. So I think it's a great, and plus you're using up your, you know, it could be a silver medalist from another search, you know, the client could only hire one person. The other person was pretty much equally as good. It just seems like wasteful to not place them, right? You've already done the hard work to recruit them. How can we just make more revenue with, you know, the inventory you've already got? But billing $1 million for the first time, tell me about that.
Oof. It was fun.
paint a picture, like, as in the first person, like, where are you? What's going on around you? Like, that moment when you're like, you realize that you've achieved that goal.
Yeah. You know, I don't remember the where I was, you know, sort of deal. I knew I was tracking towards it, and it was, I think it was in hand before it happened. It came right down to the wire. I mean, it was like $1,000 or something over. But there was a sense of accomplishment, and then, you know, like, okay, you know, what's next? But, you know, nothing too crazy. I think we went out and did a nice dinner or something like that.
All right. Awesome. So at least you said you had a celebratory dinner. So that's cool. What, So, well, okay. I think it's worth just reflecting on this because sometimes, like, people often will almost fantasize about a particular goal and imagine how thrilling and how awesome it will be to achieve that. But the way you're describing it was almost like, oh, okay, well, I guess I did it. So what am I doing next? Like, was there, how long did this sort of that high last for before you were thinking about, okay, now I need to go back to work? And
well, certainly, I mean, it came, you know, over the holiday break, you know, kind of the Thanksgiving to Hanukkah Christmas period. And so there, certainly that is a time to reflect and, you know, take stock and celebrate that win, no doubt. You know, my wife comes from a big family that loves to celebrate Christmas. So being down there with her and, you know, it's lovely. Right. But, you know, you look around at the company that we keep, you know, with the Pinnacle Society, and millions, not such a big deal there. So that's why you got to, you know, kind of, hey, what's next? Right.
Fantastic. So then what we've talked about, like, your discipline when it comes to planning, researching companies that you want to break into, focusing in on a niche, mastering your craft, reading, training, doing internal, like, your weekly training and so on. We've talked about NPC marketing. What were some of the other, thinking about the 80-20 principle, Nate, like, what do you think are the biggest factors that allowed you to go from 400 to a million? Because that's a 400 already is excellent. And that's another huge jump. So what's the difference in strategy and activity and mindset between 400 and a million?
Well, you have to every year. And this is something that I didn't realize that I was subconsciously, I guess I must've been making an effort to do it. You have to get a good new client every year. You know, I don't know if you were talking about the 80-20, you know, 80% of your revenue comes from 20% of your clients. But if that ratio doesn't change, I don't think it's tenable long term. Mm. So you always have to figure out, okay, who's going to be my honeypot next year? And if your same client is your best client multiple years in a row, I can assure you that's not going to continue, right?
Exactly. Like, that can't last
the fees
forever.
Stop coming. Yeah. So that was a big thing. And I, you know, frankly, a lot of that did come through referrals. I was very fortunate, but I've gotten to a point now where I'm realizing that, hey, that luck, that's not forever. So you're going to have to go out, Nate, you're going to go out and, like, make that luck next year. Like, go get that next big client. Don't wait for, you know, one of your clients that you're doing such a great job for. And you deserve those referrals, but that doesn't mean they're going to come.
Yes, exactly. The referrals are awesome. But you have no control over them, right? That's the thing. It's not like you can just turn on a faucet when you need more business. So yeah, 80-20 it applies to a variety of things. You're right. It applies to the principle that most companies, 80% of the revenue comes from 20% of their customers. But I was thinking more in terms of your time and energy. Like, what are the 20% type of activities or strategies that generate 80% of your results?
Doing a great job recruiting, mm-hmm. You know, I think is absolutely key, because if you're not finding the absolute best candidates, you're not going to fill the role. And most importantly, you're not going to wow the client. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think if you were to talk to any of my, you know, longer kind of tenured clients, they would say, like, hey, we've never worked with a recruiter that does a better job than Nate. And of course, as you mentioned, focusing on that relationship first, like taking the time before I'll do a search, I've got to see their office. You know, I don't care if that means hopping on a flight. You know, of course, if I'm going to go through that effort, I expect it to be, you know, retained or to take a performance deposit, something along those lines. But, you know, putting in the effort on the front end to get to know the client, and then just unbelievable job on recruiting, you know, finding the best candidates, and then living inside their head, right?
What can you say more about that? What do you mean living inside their head?
Like the client doesn't pay us to find a resume and send it. It pays us to, like, you know, to get inside their head and live there and deliver them across the finish line.
I'm so
to understand, you know, their motivation, their family, you know, what, where do they want to be in 5 years? That's always the most important question.
Yeah.
I tell candidates, look, it's my job to give you an option. And then it's your job to decide if that option is right for you to take. Yes. And of course, like there's a bit of a song and a dance there and playing a game, but it's the truth, right? Mm-hmm. Like we can't, and especially in what I do, like most of the candidates I work with are smarter than I am. So it's not like I'm going to trick them into taking a job, but I just want them to feel like I've got their best interests at heart.
Yes. Okay. There's a lot to unpack there. And I do want to talk about your philosophy. I think is really cool, relationship before the transaction. So before we dive into that, though, get inside their head and live there. That's a great way of putting it. I hadn't heard that particular expression before, but I get what you're saying. And I think that is ultimately where the best recruiters are going to be able to continue to differentiate themselves, because my team and I are offering a course in the first quarter next year on AI powered recruiting. And I believe AI is going to take over a lot of the things that recruiters currently spend time doing. But the thing that, artificial intelligence can't do is what you said, get inside the candidate's head and live there, get people across the line, the high touch things that require empathy, deep connection and really understanding what's most important to people and being able to marry those up with what your client is looking for. That's where the client still needs us to perform that function, right? Do you have any thoughts about that?
No. I try pretty much if any vendor comes and pitches me, some new software, I pretty much try them all. I think I've tried all of the AI tools that are out there right now. Mm-hmm. It's just not ready for prime time. I don't disagree with you that they will ultimately do a lot of sourcing. I don't see it. I don't see it competing with manual sourcing right now today. But to your point, I don't think it'll ever get to be able to take a candidate through the process as effectively. Now, maybe 100 years, whatever, we'll see. But
I don't think it's gonna be 100 years, because like it's developing so fast. That's the crazy thing. It's a bit like, if you think about the birth of the internet and how far that's come, and then smartphones, it's gonna be like that, but instead of it being over 20 years from the original mobile phones to smartphones, it's gonna be more like the next 2 years. Experiencing that level of rapid change. But look, coming to your relationship building philosophy, relationship before transaction, can you unpack that and explain where that comes from and how it plays out in practice?
I don't know where it comes from. I think that's just been a characteristic of mine to have a really big, robust, and it takes effort in your personal life. I mean, calling, people that you don't see regularly to keep in touch. So I've always been good at that and having a really big, meaningful friend network. But then, it's harder to, it's really, to get a great client, it's a lot harder to get it than to keep it. Mm-hmm. And that, to keep it is to keep the relationship, to keep that first and always keep the relationship in mind. And so, if it's somebody you think you might like to have a friendship with outside work, of course you have to be very careful with that. And, ethically, you're going to do it responsibly, but, taking the time, as I said, as simple as saying, hey, this search sounds awesome. I'm your guy, but before we talk to a candidate, like I have to be able to explain, what the flooring's like, what's the desk set up? Like, what's the break room look like? Those are things that might not sound that important, but when you're truly competing for top talent, like, just sending a job description and, a link to who the hiring manager is, that's not going to cut it nowadays.
Awesome. And so it sounds like you are a natural kind of relationship builder and something you work at, but what are some, you know, practical, like things that you do to really cement those relationships and in order to create value longer term?
Yeah. I mean, look, anytime I make a placement, of course, if it's a new client, like taking that client out to a nice dinner or lunch, you know, it doesn't have to be overly extravagant, but, and sometimes you can't make it work. And it, you know, if it's maybe just a happy hour or a breakfast, but you know, there's going to be times you can't make it work. But if you ask multiple times and they say, hey, you know, can't do it, it's still that effort is there. You know, drop donuts off at their office if they can't get out. So, and then on the candidate side, same thing, always offer to, you know, to see them after they've started.
You know, I think that is, for whatever reason, recruiters often follow up with clients after placement, but for some reason, you know, after they place a candidate, they never reach out to them again, which I think is a huge mistake as far as, and a missed opportunity really, apart from just it being the, you know, best practice to ensure that sure. people are you know, happy and set up for success in their new role. Has there been any time where there was a conflict between getting a deal done and looking after the relationship? Because you've prioritized those in that statement. When you say relationship before transaction, you're saying this before this, which suggests that those two things could sometimes be at odds with each other.
Yeah, nothing jumps out and comes to mind, Mark. I mean, you know, the one thing I'll say is, like, you know, we're all faced sometimes with dilemmas. And so a candidate that I've placed, you know, at a client that maybe isn't so important to me long-term, saying, hey, you know, I heard you're working on this search, I'm not so happy, you know, and kind of think about, you know, hey, sorry, man, that's a client. And even though I haven't made a placement there in the last 6 months, you know, I have in the last 14 months or 16 months. And unfortunately, you know, I'm here for you. If I can make an introduction, you know, that doesn't constitute any sort of a fee or things like that, you know, maybe I can think about it, but yeah, you know, I really can't help you. And I'm sorry. And they understand why.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an interesting topic by itself, off limits and, you know, how you, because different recruiters have different policies, I guess, when it comes to what is an off limits company. But I think integrity requires you to be almost set those parameters up front and then communicate those parameters to, you know, clients and candidates you're working with and then stay true to whatever you've agreed or you know, set out to do, rather than kind of make it up as you go along and make different decisions, you know, depending on how you're feeling on any given day. But yeah, I respect that. Talk about your path to the niche that you currently specialize in, because your group is private equity search. So how did you get from placing auditors to specializing in private equity?
Yeah, it just it was quite organic that a good portion of the initial auditors that I happened to recruit were auditing real estate private equity funds here in Denver. There's you know, there was a group of four or five of these funds, and so, you know, these candidates would want to go work at you know, folks like the companies they were auditing. You know, typically in accounting and finance capacities, right? So I would market these candidates to, you know, to real estate funds, and you know, had a couple of early wins doing that. And so same thing, like taking these, you know, controllers, directors of finance at these funds out to lunch and you know, get more business. And then the next thing I knew, they were saying, hey, you know, can I introduce you to our you know, our SVP of investments, you know, he was wondering if you could help find an analyst. And so you start picking off these entry level investment roles at these real estate funds. And, you know, next thing I know, I'm, you know, getting higher level searches. And that sort of like organic, just here and there doing more kind of front of the house oriented positions, kind of grew and grew. And then it was actually, it was January of 2019 that, that we sort of had the brainchild to start a separate division that would focus on private equity investment oriented roles. At the time, it was really almost exclusively real estate. I'd say over the last 3 years that, you know, that has changed. And now we, real estate is still the majority of what we do. I think it's about 65% of my group's placements are with in real estate investment and development firms. But now we also have a, you know, a burgeoning middle market private equity practice. We do a little work with asset managers, hedge funds, places like that. So yeah, it's fantastic. And I think we're really the only truly private equity oriented search firm that's based in Denver. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a couple other competitors that we run into that that play in Denver, but that is a bit of our calling card now. And we're able to provide our clients, you know, we essentially serve as a conduit to top tier talent in, we'll call it more coastal markets. But we try to identify candidates that have a genuine desire and a narrative that they want to be in Denver. It's, you know, it can be difficult to just say, hey, it's a great opportunity, but it's in Denver. The trick is finding those candidates who maybe grew up here, or have family here, or more inclined towards the outdoors. And so that's our value prop, is being a Denver based shop that provides our clients access, you know, seamless access to talent from anywhere.
Got it. So your clients, you're placing people predominantly in the Denver market, but you might be recruiting nationally. Is that the idea?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's probably about 15 to 20% of our placements are relos.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
And what's your kind of most effective shortcut for identifying those candidates who might be, because you mentioned, like, did they go to school in Denver or do they like the outdoors? What, I mean, obviously you know where people went to school.
Referrals.
Okay.
Yeah. It's referrals. It's just having done this now for 5 solid years. You know, people we place will say, hey, I've got a buddy that, you know, really wants to get out to Denver, and you meet that person. It might be a couple years before you place them, but
right.
Of course, as you said, we can identify people who went to school in Colorado,
yeah,
you know, fairly easily, but it's more that word of mouth that, oh, there's this shop in Denver that, you know, specializes in placing investment professionals in Denver.
Yes. So we've got a client, totally different market, different location, but they actually really focus on promoting their city as a place to live. You know, it's like, in terms of quality of life, you know, the lifestyle you can get compared to a major market like New York or LA or something. So they actively, like, both on LinkedIn as well as in their email campaigns, when they're reaching out to recruit for their clients locally, they really focus on selling the location as a big part of it. And so then they almost don't need to, I mean, obviously it helps if someone has some connection or some tie to Denver already, but they probably cast a wider net and kind of like sell the location. Is that something that you've done or?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The challenge becomes our clients are extra cognizant to the fact that, like, okay, maybe somebody just wants to come experience Denver for a couple of years, and then, you know, they're not going to want to stay. Mm. So it's a delicate balance that,
sure,
you have to strike.
Yeah, yeah, I know, that makes sense.
We saw also in the States, you know, right at the beginning of COVID, there was a mad dash to cities like Denver. So that's subsided substantially.
Fair enough. And by the way, shout out to Jenny at Apex Recruitment Group. You're the one I'm talking about, so you probably recognized yourself from that description. Jenny, James, and Ryan at Apex. So listen, you now are building a team as well, right? How many people are in your group, Nate?
So there's three of us. Okay. Yeah, I've got two full desk recruiters that work alongside me.
Okay, great. So I think being a billing manager is one of the toughest jobs in recruiting, right? Because you still have to do everything that you did when you are just a recruiter looking after your own clients, your own desk. But now you also need to mentor, coach, train, manage, develop multiple other people. How have you managed to navigate that just to give some context to this question, there's obviously four possible outcomes here. And I've seen all four of these play out. So option one, obviously, is the one which we're going for, which is you are able to maintain and continue the high level of performance that you're already established, and you're able to help your team members to also achieve at a really high level. So that's what, of course, we want. Now, I have seen scenarios where either the manager continues achieving, but they leave their team members behind and their team members are struggling. I've also seen the flip side of that, which is the group manager partner almost overdoes it when it comes to trying to support their team and puts too much emphasis on that and neglects their own billings. And so then the team members thrive, but they're not performing as they were before. And of course, the worst case scenario is, you put a huge amount of effort in other people, they don't perform, but you don't perform either, right? So how have you navigated that in order to make sure that everybody is performing at their best?
Starts with hiring great people that fit within both the larger culture of our company, but then the culture that I've developed, for myself and by extension for the group I'm building. But then I'd say we sort of bifurcate the idea of the training. So as we talked about earlier, training is a big part of the High Country Search Group writ large of our ethos. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the, we have a way of going about our business, the basic recruiting methodology that we follow at High Country Search. So that training is done concurrent and even somewhat initial to like, okay, this is what a senior investment analyst looks like. This is what a VP of asset management looks like. The the core of what we do is handled a little bit by the main infrastructure at my company.
Yep.
So that takes care of itself. And then, both of my guys are, super bright, great people. They came to me with one had significant recruiting experience, one had none. And so it's just being smart to the fact that it's not, it's not a one size fit all solution. Mm-hmm. Again, the basic nuts and bolts that, we get in terms of our methodology, I think that then carries over into my practice and then just kind of massaging a little bit and, changing some word tracks. But then, I think to be direct, like, a lot of our success has been because we've got these great clients where we focused first on the relationship, and we get, even if one year they're a huge client, the next year maybe it's just a couple of placements, but we're getting repeat business every year from a lot of the same groups, and so we've been fortunate that we've had great jobs to work on. So it's not one answer of how to continue to be successful, but I'll say I would not be as successful as I am without the two guys that work with me. And so that means something, right? Yeah. Like it's not, I'm not just holding them up.
Absolutely.
We're all helping each other.
I love that. And 100%, like hiring, you can't overstate how important it is that you have to hire the right people, which should be obvious considering the industry we're in, but I don't know. I see often people are struggling with their team members aren't kind of getting there, and having the right people just who are self-motivated and almost self-managing is so important. I know Monty is very selective about who gets to join Hike Country, right? And so I like that philosophy of if it's not a hell yes, then it's a no. Kind of only bringing people on board who are going to be a net positive to the culture, to the overall performance, that are going to add something rather than detract something. And then you also mentioned, of course, you've built your practice already. So you have repeat clients that, you know, means that your team members already have great quality jobs to work on. That's huge as well. So you've almost built the demand and you've hired fantastic people. It's almost inevitable that you guys are going to make something happen, right?
That's the idea.
All right. Awesome. You've made it sound as if everything you touch turns to gold. Like, have there been moments of doubt or adversity in your career where you've really had to dig deep to turn things?
Of course, Mark.
Yeah.
I mean, this is 10 years in. I didn't bill a million until my eighth year.
Right.
I'm not coasting by working 30 hours a week, man. There's, you know, it is not, it's not everything. It's not the Midas touch. That said, I think right now we're at an inflection point. You know, we're probably, you know, if a couple of offers get out this week that I think, well, we'll build just as much as we built last year, but very well could build less. And that, you know, that's not what I expected. I expected my group to hit 2 million this year, and we're not going to do that. That was my goal. I had a stretch goal of 2.2 million. We're certainly not going to hit that. So no, this year was a setback. Now, I'm framing it up as a huge win because, you know, the newer of the two recruiters I had took a important step in his development. So I think we're, you know, collectively as a group, we're much better positioned, but we've got to open up some new doors and get new clients, or next year could be worse than this year. So by all means, it's not, nothing is given in this world. And so we're focused next year, you know, trying to every month go to a new city, you know, in this sort of Mountain West region and go on a bit of a roadshow every month and get, you know, get meetings, in-person meetings. So
I think
check back with me, yeah, this time next year, and hopefully we'll have accomplished, you know, the goals that we set out to accomplish this year that we did not accomplish. And I'm not going to blame it. Not going to blame it on the economy. Certainly, you know, may have had an impact, but I believe, you know, that it was my fault for not accomplishing what we wanted to.
Well, the fact is, it's the market. I'm sure was a huge factor. The thing is that we have no control over that, right? We can only control our own mindset, you know, actions, behaviors. So, could we just spend 5 minutes delving into that, Nate? What's your approach? What's your mindset? You know, moving into 2024, what are you doing differently in order to? Let me ask the question differently. What did you learn from 2023, not achieving everything that you had hoped to initially?
That there are people that are getting job orders and clients that I am not, that I feel I would be a better partner for XYZ company. So, and that just gets back to what I'm going to do differently. And that is put a much more concerted effort towards a formulaic marketing strategy.
Awesome. So I like that. There's obviously people still getting jobs, right? And so somebody is placing those people, that should be us. So then how do we achieve that? So we need to have a formulaic marketing strategy. And what does that look like?
It's coming together. Certainly have done the research in all the markets that we want to ultimately play in, knowing who all the players are, and then going up a layer deeper and figuring out at you know, specific companies, who are the key people we want to be marketing towards, and then, you know, getting a campaign set up. We did sign up for Interstellar, so
going to leverage, going to leverage that. And then potentially figure out some, I don't know if that's going to be take place early 24, but maybe a little bit more SEO and some target markets potentially.
Awesome. I like your roadshow idea. That's fantastic. Like getting FaceTime with your clients is, I don't know why, like that, that's what we always used to do in the really olden days, but people don't seem to do it as much. So I think that could be a differentiator right there. The thing with Interstellar is that's just the tool, right? It's really the strategy that sits behind that. And then the messaging, getting the messaging right, which is critical. Interstellar is a great tool, but in and of itself, it's not going to turn things around. So, you know, the messaging is super, super important, as well as the overall strategy. So like we talked about NPC as a tactical way of, you know, giving you a campaign you could load up in Interstellar. But what, how about a podcast? Have you thought about?
I love listening to podcasts so much that I just don't like the sound of my voice. I'm sure a lot of people say that.
That is absolutely an excuse because nobody likes the sound of their own voice. Everybody says the same thing. You get used to it.
I'm not ruling it out, but the chances are slim to none.
All right. So listen, you don't have to do a podcast, but what I'm saying is you need to do something that is big, right, for your industry to like set yourself above. If there's people getting orders that you guys didn't get, even though you're as good, if not better, to those competitors, right, then what we need to do is not just increase the quantity of messaging and send out Interstellar campaigns. We want to like make a move that is big. Think big, and what can we do to really dominate that market and be everywhere? So when you said systematic marketing campaign or methodical marketing, that's what I'm thinking is like, what is the big idea? And then, you know, let's execute on that through phone calls, Interstellar, et cetera. So we're out of time, unfortunately, because I'd love to discuss that more with you. But if you want to chat about it anytime, then let me know.
Will do, man. It was a pleasure. I've been looking forward to this. I've got to enjoy your work. So thank you for your time.
Thanks, Nate. Thank you. I've loved our conversation, and yeah, thanks for sharing the insights and the mindset. I think is there's no question that mindset is a huge, huge factor. In fact, so you're obviously someone who you go after what you want, and you put yourself forward, and
nobody's going to do it for you.
Absolutely. Nate, it's a pleasure. I'll look forward to our next conversation. Have an awesome day.